From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is weighing in on ABC's decision yesterday to cancel Trump supporter Roseanne Barr's show because of her racist tweet about Obama advisor Valerie Jarrett. Barr wrote, "Muslim Brotherhood and Planet of the Apes had a baby equals VJ." The apes reference, of course, a slur on her being black. The president tweeted today, "Bob Iger of ABC called Valerie Jarrett to let her know that ABC does not tolerate comments like those made by Roseanne Barr. Gee, he never called President Donald J. Trump to apologize for the horrible statements made and said about me on ABC. Maybe I just didn't get the call."
Our political strategists join us, and this week it's Republican strategist Alice Stewart. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy and Robin. How are you?
Doing well. And Democratic strategist Karine Jean-Pierre. Hi, Karine.
Hey there, Jeremy. Hey there, Robin.
So African-American journalist April Ryan in the White House press corps called ABC's canceling of Roseanne a huge moment in the Trump era. Alice, do you agree?
I agree 100%. I think we have gotten to the point where we're normalizing racist, disparaging comments. And at some point, there has to be some semblance of consequences for this kind of behavior. And ABC certainly took a risk putting Roseanne Barr on. She's known for controversial comments and statements and behavior. They took a risk putting her on. They lost, and I commend them for taking her off and canceling her show. I would like to see, but I'm not going to hold my breath, the president to actually come around and actually condemn the comments that she made and state unequivocally that there's no tolerance for that kind of behavior. But that would be the height of hypocrisy.
Are you saying President Trump should do that? And it would be the height of hypocrisy if he did. Why? Because he has, you know, some people feel he's made racist statements.
Well, Robin, he has. He's made quite a few. So
people, this is the Republican strategist. I just want to point
I am
that
a
out.
Republican strategist. I voted for President Trump, and I still think this is not about political correctness. This is not about policy. This is about human decency. Mm-hmm. And when you have someone who makes statements like this, there should be some type of consequences, and someone at some point needs to stand up and say enough is enough and we can't tolerate this. Look, I'm a Republican. I support the president's policies 99.9%, but that does not mean I condone this type of behavior and comments, and I do think someone should stand up to
Well,
it.
Karine, we haven't heard anything from the Democrats about this at all. Is President Trump likely to suffer any consequences by the fact that he stood by Roseanne early on? He said, this is about us, this show. This is why it's so successful. It's about the Trump movement in this country. Is he going to face any backlash for not standing up more now?
I think we are seeing some backlash. I think Donald Trump is seeing some backlash, that's for sure, because you see the resistance. You see a movement afoot that is speaking out against Donald Trump. You saw that last year, especially if you look at the electoral kind of races that have come about from 2016. Democrats and also Republicans are crossing over, more moderate Republicans are crossing over and saying, in elections, and saying, no, we're done. We're done with what Donald Trump is doing on policies, on his language, on his behavior. And come November, I think we will see that blue wave come to fruition. And that will be certainly a rebuke of Donald Trump and the Republicans.
Well, but we have to look at recent polls that show, for instance, a growing number of Republican voters don't want Donald Trump to cooperate with the Russia investigation. Some are attributing that to his attacks on the Russia investigation and prompting people to think, yeah, it has gone on for quite a long time. So there's that. And then, although you have retiring South Carolina Republican Trey Gowdy, chair of the House Oversight Committee, who told Fox News last night he looked at all the evidence when lawmakers were shown documents from the Russia investigation. He saw no evidence of spying on the Trump campaign. He said the FBI was doing what Americans should want, talking to people about connections to Russia. Here's some more of what he said.
I think when the president finds out what happened, he's going to be not just fine. He's going to be glad that we have an FBI that took seriously what they heard. He was never the target. Russia
is the
target.
So it sounds to me as if
Republican strategist Alice Stewart, what would you advise Republicans to be saying here? Trey Gowdy is retiring. So some would say he can afford to go against President Trump's narrative.
I think we need to listen to people who have actually heard what has gone on here. And I believe and I trust Trey Gowdy. And if he says unequivocally, as he said, that he's convinced more than ever the FBI did exactly what people would want them to do when they get information about Russians' involvement in the election, and it has nothing to do specifically with Donald Trump, they did exactly what they should do. And this is not about Spygate. This is not about a witch hunt. This is about getting to the root of what this all is about, which is a foreign entity interfering in our election process. And that is something that we need to get to the bottom of. And Trey Gowdy, I think a lot of him, and I'm reminded one thing I say often when he was during Benghazi mm-hmm. and he was questioning Hillary Clinton. He said, there's no statute of limitations on the truth. And the same applies here. Until we get to the truth here with regard to Russian interference, we need to turn off the clock and let Robert Mueller do his job.
There's some interesting state politics going on. I want to get to that. The Missouri governor, Eric Greitens, who is seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, just resigned yesterday in the face of criminal investigations, a couple of them. Charges have been dropped, but let's take a listen to Greitens.
This ordeal has been designed to cause an incredible amount of strain on my family. Millions of dollars of mounting legal bills, endless personal attacks.
So, Corrine, there's some talk in Missouri that this could help Democrats because the attorney general there may end up facing Claire McCaskill, a Democratic senator from Missouri, in what was supposed to be a pretty closely watched Senate race this fall. What are you thinking?
Well, I think Claire McCaskill is an astute, smart politician. She's been around for a long time in Missouri, so I think that she alone will do a fantastic job and get herself reelected.
But people were worried that she might not be able to do that in this environment. Trump won Missouri by a lot.
Right, and I agree, but we also worried about that the last time around, 6 years ago, and she was able to get reelected.
Right.
Look, I think that Republicans clearly are not doing themselves a favor here in that particular state with the governor resigning, and now we're going to see how this is going. It is going to have a reverberating effect, clearly, with the election coming up in November.
You know, Alice Stewart, again, the Republican strategist, I just have to ask you, what would you advise Eric Greitens? I mean, here he's saying the ordeal has been designed to cause strain on my family. No, some would say his activity was designed, his extramarital activity was designed to cause strain on his family. What would you have advised him?
First of all, as you say, extramarital activity causes strain on a marriage, not the political environment. And my advice would have been, A, don't have, extramarital affair in the first place. And granted, that happened prior to the office he's holding now. But certainly come clean, put it all out there. Ask for forgiveness, certainly from your wife and your family, but from the public. And when that doesn't work, then you have an obligation as a political official to step down and let someone else get in that spot that will actually serve the people of Missouri well. And it's incumbent upon the party there to make sure they don't have another Greitens or Todd Akin come up and be the nominee. We need to have good, credible, legitimate candidates that represent the Republican Party.
He was obviously not your client. We'll move on to something else.
Yeah.
The Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren told ABC's The View yesterday that she wasn't ready to join other Democrats who support impeachment of President Trump.
I'm not there.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
Where I am is that we need this independent investigation without political interference. Look, that's what we owe to the American people.
Corrine, as you know, there are these commercials airing from Tom Steyer from California saying there should be impeachment of President Trump. But a lot of Democrats, including apparently Elizabeth Warren, seem to be a little nervous about that.
I think, look, I get asked this question a lot about impeachment. Should Democrats run on impeachment? I think Democrats should run on that, but other things. I think that Donald Trump clearly has done some things like firing James Comey that is clearly being investigated by Robert Mueller, obstruction of justice. And he's done a lot more, a long list of things that are incredibly questionable for the president of the United States, the person who sits in the Oval Office, to be doing. But it's not the only thing. I think Democrats on the right side of history history here. They can talk about health care and how Republicans try to take health care away from 32 million people. They can talk about tax reform, how that's not helping. It's not trickling down and helping the middle class, and Republicans are running away from that. There are things here that they can truly have a conversation about, and that will resonate with the public.
I want to ask Alice, because aren't Republicans seeing polling that shows that people don't like that? People don't like this notion of calling for impeachment.
You're right. Well, I agree 100%. I think it would be a tremendous mistake for Democrats to put too much of an emphasis on that. And I think Corrine was suggesting make that part of the dialogue, but not the entire dialogue. In my view, I think the Democrats should have learned a big lesson with Hillary Clinton's loss, in that you need to focus on what the constituents are concerned with. And I still think it is jobs, it's the economy, it's health care. And I know for a fact the Republicans on the congressional side, they're polling what is the top interest for that specific congressional district or that state, and focusing on that. Granted, there's not concrete evidence that there was collusion with the Russians, and there's not concrete evidence there was not, and we need to let it play out.
Republican strategist Alice Stewart and Democratic strategist Corrine Jean-Pierre, thanks to both of you.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
At a rally in Nashville last night, President Trump defended his rhetoric on immigration, saying it would be an asset in the upcoming midterm elections.
And you can say what you want, but I think border security and security general is a great issue for the Republican Party.
Earlier this month, the Trump administration announced that it's ending temporary protected status, or TPS, for nearly 57,000 Hondurans in the U.S. Temporary protected status gives legal status to migrants who are already in the U.S. when their country suffers a conflict or natural disaster. Joining us now from Los Angeles is Martin Pineda, who is one of the organizers of Central American Resource Center. That's the largest Central American organization in the country. And also joining us is Marta Connor, who is a TPS holder from Honduras, living in Southern California. Welcome to both of you. And let me first ask you, Marta, what this decision by the Trump administration means for you and other Hondurans living in the U.S.
It means for me separation of families. All those families, they have their children here. Some of them even have grandchildren. And that means separation.
You have children here?
I do.
Who are U.S. citizens?
Yes.
So would you have to be separated from your children if you have to go back to Honduras?
Yes.
How likely do you think that is?
With this administration, there's a high number, how could I say it? It's
possibility
that it will happen. But my hopes are really high since I'm in the National TPS Alliance. So we are working together to see if we could change the mentality of this administration.
Martin, what are you advising people like Marta to do?
I'm an organizer for the Central American Resource Center, and then we anchor what is called the National TPS Alliance. So what that is, it's a collective of TPS holders who we're helping them build their leadership so they can fight for themselves. So we don't want to be the voice for them when they have all the right to speak on behalf of themselves and what they've contributed to this country and what this means for them and their humanity. So we advise all TPS holders to get informed of what their rights are, about the ongoing efforts that there is right now for a more permanent solution for TPS.
Is there anything that they can do, though, if Congress, for example, or the president don't act on their behalf?
At this moment right now, there's different kind of adjustments that could be made. For example, there's like in certain states, if you have a U.S. citizen children of age 21 or older who can petition for you, there's different varieties of ways to get adjustments of status, but in reality, for the larger population of TPL soldiers, at this moment, there is no pathway to citizenship or residency at this moment.
Marta, how old are your kids?
My older is 25. Mm-hmm. I have a 21 and a 23-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hondurans were first given TPS in 1999 after Hurricane Mitch devastated the country. You were already living in the U.S. when the earthquake hit. Were you here legally at the time of the earthquake?
No.
No. And did you try to get your citizenship over the last 20 years? Was that a possibility for you?
Yes. My husband did apply for my residence, and he passed away. Mm-hmm. And the appointment for my residence came like 6 months after he passed away. Mm-hmm. And there was a law that say that if your husband was only a resident, that I was not going to be able to get my residence. So I didn't mm-hmm. at that time. So that's why I'm a TPS holder right now.
Mm-hmm. And what about the fact that this was always supposed to be temporary? Did it change how you decided what to do? I mean, did you think that at some point you would have to go back to Honduras?
No.
Why not?
Oh, because I have my children here, and the situation in my country is not the one that I want my kids to. I didn't want them to live in that situation that I live. So not even when I was, even when I didn't have the TPS, I was not thinking to take them back over there. So it never crossed my mind mm-hmm. to go back.
And Martine, how would you answer that? I mean, many people look at this and say the word temporary is in TPS. It's always supposed to be temporary.
After 20 years, there's nothing temporary about it, I would say. I mean, there's a lot of different conditions why TPS was created. I mean, you could say it was the natural disasters, but the conditions in Central America have never been good. There's always been instability to this day and age in Honduras. As conditions have only gotten worse. There's political unrest. There's human rights violations every day, and like particularly like the Salvadoran community who fled the civil war and were seeking political asylum. Many were denied, and I mean, it's not. There's a lot of U.S. Intervention in these countries that cause a lot of the conditions why people leave. And so, I mean, after 20 years, temporary is just not. People have established their families. They've built homes. They've established businesses. And I think they've been long overdue for a more permanent solution. And TPS holders are just more a lot. They're a lot more than their contributions. They're human beings who have left their whole life here, and they have no intention of going back because they fled for a reason. It's not just because they're seeking a better life.
But what would you say to people who say it's not the United States' responsibility to take in people who, at this point, the reason why the status was extended to Hondurans is because of an earthquake that happened over 20 years ago, and that presumably has been dealt with by now?
I mean, the conditions have not, even with the earthquake.
There are bad conditions in Honduras. I take your point on that. Yeah. But the reason why they got TPS in the first place was not because of violence in the country.
I mean, the violence has always been there. It's only gotten worse. And I mean, it was for an earthquake, but there's just so many conditions that the U.S. is involved in Honduras that cause people to leave, especially in other countries of Central America.
So, Marta, what are you preparing for? It sounds like you're not preparing to go back to Honduras. So what are you going to do?
I'm going to continue fighting. I am a member of the TPS Alliance, National TPS Alliance. I'm not only a member, but I'm also a person who fights and moves. And I'm just telling people to come out and speak their voice. Because we do have we have rights here in this country. We've been living here for so long. You know, when I hear temporary, it's like, okay, we have homes here, we have businesses here, we have our children, our grandchildren. So we just can't just pick up and go to a country, especially for our children, to move to a country where they really, this is their country. This is their country. And also, we as TPS holders, we recognize this country as our country too. And we have been paying our taxes and working. We are very hardworking people here.
Martine, your organization has filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court against the Trump administration to stop this from happening. Do you think you'll be successful?
I believe strongly we will, because there's a lot of great arguments against the decisions. There's already been proof that there were advice to the Trump administration not to end temporary protected status, but they still went and go ahead and did it anyway. The comments he made about these countries, and then also just the rights of these U.S. citizen children who are being they're looking at a face of having to leave the country that they were born into to go to another. To leave with their parents or stay here. I mean, a lot of them won't be even 18 by the time their parents' temporary protected status ends.
Marta, there's been so much in the news recently about immigration, a lot of tough language on both sides. What do you think of the national debate about this issue right now?
It's very confusing. People really doesn't know us. They doesn't know our story. They doesn't know our history. And they're talking like the only one that I saw lately is someone that I have a documentary, and that person say, "Oh, you've been living here for 30 years. The government have feed you for 30 years." No, that's not right, because I have been working. I have been paying my taxes. I have a good job. Learned the language, which is English, is my second language, mm-hmm. and so I have been doing very good. And if you go to the TPS Alliance, you're going to meet wonderful working people, hardworking people. So they can just say that we are living here. Everybody who have TPS have to work, because we got a work permit. So for them to say that we are not working and that we are on welfare, getting food stamps. Mm-hmm. I don't know who they're talking about, because this is not the National TPS Alliance. Those 13 countries, those are very working people.
Well, that's Marta Connor, who is a TPS holder from Honduras. We've also been speaking with Martin Pineda, who's one of the organizers of Central American Resource Center. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah.
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
Global markets are fainting in response to political chaos in Italy. Last weekend, two populist parties failed to form a coalition government when the Italian president rejected their choice of economic minister, fearing the economist would lead Italy out of the EU and out of use of the euro. So that instability is sowing doubt in financial markets. Yesterday, Italian bonds had their worst sell-off since the creation of the euro. Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure, is here. Robin, help us with this. Let's start with the politics. The Italian president, he's in a showdown with the leaders of the anti-establishment Five Star Party and the far-right party known as the League. Both came to power after the election in March, now trying to form this government. But these parties, they didn't campaign on leaving the EU, right?
I mean, it's great fodder politically. Look how far populism has gone in the UK. I mean, you know Brexit. Well, now there's banter about Quitali Italive, and basta.
And enough.
Italy is a member of, well, there's one more thing, the pigs, you know, including Greece and Spain. These are the sick children of Europe. And these weaker economies, they don't have the clout within the EU that Germany and France enjoy. And on top of that, Italy is so indebted, and it's the third largest economy in the Eurozone. But the other side of that is, you know, you can't devalue your way out of this rut. Your economic self-determination is limited, and so populism really resounds.
Well, so these two parties came up. But as I was saying, they didn't campaign on leaving the EU, but it sounds as if the president thinks they're trying to pull a sneaky move and put an economic minister in who would drive Italy to leave the EU.
I think people benefit from the moral hazard, kind of playing chicken with the prospect of leaving, because it would be so devastating if the third biggest economy in the Eurozone were to just, you know, try to leave, pull off a Brexit. It would be so much more messy than what, you know, the UK did. Europe's made the collective decision that it's far preferable to accommodate people like this, like Greece and the other sick children, than to risk letting them go all Lehman Brothers and exit, which is going to then send shocks into Paris, Berlin, the global financial system. So, you know, you've seen this, Robin. The crisis has rolled across Ireland, Spain, Greece for years now, and they're fundamental problems with the EU that if you're a politician in Italy, I mean, you can run miles around how these problems haven't been addressed.
Well, but the president has appointed an interim prime minister, a moderate, who's a former official at the International Monetary Fund, seeming to try to send the signal to the markets that, no, we're not leaving the EU or the euro. But markets are worried, as we just said. I mean, the U.S. market plunged as well. Is it far-fetched to think that Italy might?
You know, we get periodic reminders that it's hard to keep this dam standing. Brexit, we said before, was unthinkable, and governments that roll into power inveighing against austerity, they're just going to see more standing if Italy achieves prominence in its kind of anti-EU rhetoric. It has maybe the most to lose if you think about the size of its debt, but it could also be looked at as the most to hurt the rest of the world with. Italy's economy is 10 times the size of Greece's, and it's the second most indebted economy in the Eurozone.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, is that why the Dow fell more than 500 points at one point yesterday?
Look, I mean, just that tension, the anxiety with the bond volatility, nobody wants a European financial crisis. If you think about how much our companies, Coca-Cola, GE, export to places like Italy, to France, to Spain, how much foreign debt is held by U.S. and Asian multinational banks, the risk of bank failures, U.S. investors just might want to remember the volatility we saw here in 2011 when it looked as though that crisis was going to spread across the Atlantic.
Yeah, so hopefully they will figure it out in Italy. Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure, thanks as always.
Always a joy. Thank you.
Well, it's time now for a special classical edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Angela Mariani is DJ and host of Harmonia, a nationally syndicated show produced by WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. She's also a professor of musicology at Texas Tech in Lubbock, and that's where she is now. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
And I guess we should ask you first to just explain that. Your show is based in Indiana, but you're in Texas.
Right. Well, the show was founded there at WFIU when I was a graduate student. Then years later, when I moved to Lubbock, Texas, we kept doing the show, and we've been able to keep the show going and with the miracle of modern technology, you know, between both of those locations.
And when we talk about the music that you've brought us today, we said classical, but actually your show focuses on early music. How do you define early music?
Well, early music is one of those pretty broad terms, but I think of it as basically being medieval, Renaissance, and usually early Baroque music. But I'm really more interested in historical performance practice, and musicians can follow that particular thread way up into the 19th century and beyond. But mostly it's medieval, Renaissance, and Baroque music.
Well, let's hear some of the music. This is the Philadelphia-based Renaissance band Pifaro with La Rosette. This is written by the German composer Michael Praetorius. ¶¶ Tell us about this. What are we listening to here?
Well, this is what might be called a loud band. The players in Pífaro play a wonderful array of shams, sackbuts, dulcian, crumhorn, bagpipes, recorders, and occasionally lutes, guitars, harp, percussion. There's a wonderful collection of instruments. That's from a new CD that's called Back Before Bach, Musical Journeys. And it features music that J.S. Bach might have heard in his particular hometown area.
When he was growing up.
Yeah, when he was growing up, his father was one of the town musicians, or Stadtpfeifers. And so he would have heard music like that in his daily life.
Okay, well, the next one we have is from the 15th century. This is, and I hope I'm pronouncing this properly, Mit Jerta Brenna. This is performed here by the ensemble Peregrina.
Mit Jerta Brenna het som borlogs ordet skar.
Laudibus ali.
Vare min tunge gjort av stål og kunade mål.
Tavakve vim så fin.
Måte jeg slåb og gille.
So, Mit Jerta Brenna, that's Danish.
Yes, it's Danish. It's a very old version of Danish. And it's a song that is a hymn in praise of Mary. So it's a spiritual song with a religious theme.
And the composer of this piece of music is actually unknown.
Is unknown. It's really interesting. It was actually discovered in a collection of songs that had been written down in a 15th century Danish teacher's manual. For that CD, Ensemble Peregrina was joined by Benjamin Bagby, who is the director of the renowned medieval ensemble Sequentia. That's Benjamin Bagby that you can hear singing the baritone in that particular track.
So what are the lyrics about here?
The first few lines say, "My heart burns in holy flame as it should in praise for Mary. And even if my tongue were made of steel, it would still proclaim all wisdom's strength. And if only I knew how to praise the Virgin Mary, I would glorify the Queen of Queens and our mistress forever."
Hmm. All right, well, next we have the harpsichord player Byron Schenkman with the piece Diferencias sobre el canto llano de caballero, Differences on the Gentleman's Plain Song. This is by the Spanish Renaissance composer Antonio de Cabezón. Now, this is a historical harpsichord there, which is kept in Vermilion, South Dakota.
Yes, at the National Music Museum in Vermilion. It used to be called the Shrine to Music, and it's one of the largest collections of historical instruments in the world. And this was a fascinating project. Byron Schenkman got all of the historical harpsichords in one room, and he played each one of them, as he describes, fitting the repertoire as closely as possible to each instrument.
And what's happening in this piece of music?
Well, in that particular piece of music, diferencias are a kind of variation. So you have a theme, which is based on a particular canto llano, and then that theme is varied, improvised upon, and elaborated through the course of the piece.
Okay, well, the next one you brought us is Schubert's Der Leiermann, the hurdy-gurdy man, from his Winterreise song cycle performed by Natasha Mirkovich de Roe and Matthias Leubner.
Drüben hinterm Dorfe steht ein Leiermann. Und mit starren Fingern dreht er, was er kann. Barfuß auf dem Eise wankt er hin und her.
Sounds very eerie.
It does. It does. It's very haunting.
What's the story this song is telling?
Well, the story has to do with a lone hurdy-gurdy man out in a field outside the outskirts of town, playing all by himself. And he's just standing there with numb fingers playing, and the local dogs are all barking at him. And he just keeps playing, keeps playing, keeps playing. And at the end, the poet says, "Strange ancient one, shall I walk with you? Would you crank my songs on your instrument too?"
And how does the hurdy-gurdy work?
The hurdy-gurdy is a really interesting instrument, and I think it's a somewhat misunderstood instrument. People kind of associate it with a kind of caricature of an organ grinder, but it's actually a very sophisticated instrument. There's a crank at the end of it that turns a wooden wheel, and the wooden wheel bows a set of strings. So you have to actually rosin the wheel. And then inside, the strings extend through the instrument up to the peg box, and on the outside, you have a series of keys. And so with the left hand, the player presses those keys just as you would an accordion or keyboard instrument or something like that, and they press down on the strings that are being bowed by the wooden wheel as you're turning the crank. So it's quite a complicated mechanism.
Now, before we let you go, Angela, I just want to clear something up. Your show is called Harmonia, not Harmonia. Why is that?
Yes. Well, Harmonia is actually the Greek pronunciation of this word that had to do with the harmony of the spheres, the music of the spheres that the medieval theorists used to write about.
All right. Well, then Harmonia it is. Angela Mariani, DJ and host of Harmonia, nationally syndicated show produced by WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And now we want to check in on that bizarre story today out of Ukraine. You might have heard the Russian journalist Arkady Babchenko was reported shot and killed outside his apartment in Kiev last night. Terrible. Ukrainian authorities, in effect, blame Russia because Babchenko was such a huge critic of President Putin and he'd been assassinated. His wife was in mourning. Well, today, Babchenko strolled into a televised news conference very much alive. There were gasps and applause from fellow reporters as Babchenko came out during a press conference in which Ukrainian authorities announced they'd staged his death to save his life. Let's bring in BBC Ukrainian correspondent Anastasia Gribanova in Kiev. Anastasia, stunning. We spoke to you earlier about his death. What more did officials say at the news conference about what is now a staged death?
It's a stunning piece of news indeed, and everybody here in Ukraine is totally shocked. And this is the second shock of the day, because earlier he was reported, Arkady Babchenko was reported dead, and now he's very much alive, coming to speak to everybody in one of the Ukrainian TV channels. And as Ukrainian security services say, it was staged murder, so it's correct to put it that way, that it was a special operation by the Ukrainian special forces, and it was aimed to reveal the activity of Russian security services, aimed at eliminating all those Kremlin critics who have fled Russia and have found shelter here in Ukraine.
But how does it do that? How does staging this death, and by the way, his wife was said to have found him in a pool of blood, didn't know it was a staged death? Do we understand that? And so how does doing this reveal Russian plots?
Well, the Ukrainian security services say that they knew there was an attempt of murder against Arkady Babchenko, and it was allegedly plotted in Russia, and they found out about it, and they approached Arkady to help them and cooperate and to reveal all those who were standing behind this plot, to show the real intentions of Russia in Ukraine, to show its activity, so to say, behind the scenes activity, which is underway in Ukraine and has been extremely, so to say, prominent in the recent years with the killings of journalists and activists.
I'm still stuck, Anastasia, and I'm sure many of the reporters there are as well. I'm still stuck on how preemptively, staging a murder reveals those who they think were actively seeking to kill him.
Well, as they put it, the security services of Ukraine put it, this was just one of the episodes in a bigger campaign conducted by the Ukrainian security service. They say that they penetrated into the criminal group which was about to shoot Mr. Babchenko. They knew every movement and every coordinated was happening very, very closely.
Did they arrest anyone?
Yeah, they arrested. They arrested the suspect. The suspect. Let me just put it this way: a person has been arrested, and this person is actually an intermediary who hired an assassin in Ukraine to kill Arkady Babchenko. And this intermediary paid $30,000 for this murder to be committed. Security services have just shown a couple of shots. A couple of video clips showing the detention of a man, which can hardly be recognized right now. So no details have been disclosed so far. But this is as much as we know as of the moment.
This is so incredible because we began the day, as we said, with people mourning, especially since he had written on his Facebook a few hours before this staged murder, that on this day, 4 years ago, he'd almost died. He was getting on a helicopter to go cover the conflict in eastern Ukraine, the supporters of Russia in eastern Ukraine fighting the Ukrainians. And he didn't make it on the helicopter. It was too full. And that helicopter was shot down. And so he was kind of celebrating that he had had a birthday, and then he was suddenly dead. Now he's alive. How are people there reacting?
Well, there was a huge outburst over the social media, and even the head of the Ukrainian security service, Vasyl Hritsak, said that it's the third birthday now for Arkady Babchenko, and that was the moment when he himself, well and alive, appeared, so say, on stage to speak to the journalists. So it's a huge shock and a huge revelation for everyone, because people were so devastated by the murder, which turned out to be a staged one. And Arkady Babchenko himself, he apologized to his wife. First of all, he said apologies, my sincere apologies, because he says, I know how hard it is to lose somebody and how to feel that pain. So he apologized for that, but it was a necessary thing to do, he said, because he helped the security services to disclose this criminal activity, the claim which was going on in Ukraine against all those who were criticizing the Kremlin.
Boy, BBC Ukrainian correspondent Anastasia Grubanova, thank you so much. What a story.
What a story indeed. Thank you.
So, Jeremy, to review, the Ukrainians faked kill Babchenko so Russians would think he was dead and give the Ukrainian officials time to get the suspected assassins.
And all this on the same day as the last episode of The Americans.
See, this stuff happens.
In real life.
This stuff happens. We'll be watching tonight. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. We'll be right back.